Welcome to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
You're tuned in to the R1 News, your stop for news and current affairs on the airwaves. 11 to 12 weekdays here on Radio 191 FM, Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Tēnā koutou I tēnei ata. This is the R1 News here on Radio 1. Ko seba ho, and along with my co-host Scott, we'll be taking you through the news here on Rapere, 28th of July. Coming up on the show, I tēnei rā, we have Sophie with the news headlines and weather. Following that, we have a pre-recorded feature where I talk to Dr. Simon Kingham, the Chief Science Advisor to the Ministry of Transport. We talk about the recent study evaluating national levels of air pollution and the effects that this is having on human health. After this, my co-host Scott will be talking to Dr. Ian Chapman about universities running papers about individual celebrities in the wake of Texas State University's decision to have a paper about Harry Styles. Finally, we have a live chat with Andrew Johnson, our local zoologist, for Creature of the Week. This week is Shark Week, so we're talking great whites. But before all that, here is Lawrence Arabia with Sweet Dissatisfaction. That was Lawrence Arabia, Tamaki Makaurau based artist, with their song Sweet Dissatisfaction. You've got it tuned to the R1 News, and it's now time for news headlines with Sophie.
The R1 News headlines.
Kia ora, these are your Radio 1 News headlines for Thursday, the 28th of July. Six-time squash medalist Joelle King and reigning shot put champion Tom Walsh have been named as flag bearers for the Birmingham Commonwealth Games opening ceremony. The opening ceremony happens tonight at Alexander Stadium in Birmingham, where Peaky Blinders creator Stephen Knight has put together the creative side of a 3.5-hour, quote, mind-blowing show. The ceremony will be the first time a male and female athlete have jointly carried the New Zealand flag at the Commonwealth Games, with a recent change in game rules allowing for such an arrangement. The pair were formally announced as Ngāpō Hapai, flag bearers by Chief de Mission Nigel Avery at a team function held in the New Zealand House in Birmingham in front of more than 200 team members and Governor-General Dame Cindy Kiro. Joelle King is one of New Zealand's most decorated Commonwealth Games athletes, having won 6 medals, including 3 gold. Tom Walsh is all set for his 3rd Games appearance in Birmingham after winning a silver and then gold medal in the last 2 games. The 232-strong team looks to surpass the 46 medals won at the last Commonwealth Games in the Gold Coast. Former Otago Polytechnic Chief Executive Phil Kerr has called for an apology from Education Minister Chris Hipkins for turning the country's polytechnic education system into, quote, a national disgrace. Te Pukinga is the entity responsible for completing the transition to a unified national technical institute and industry training organisation by the end of this year. This call from Mr Kerr comes in the wake of last week's apology from Te Pukinga's acting chief executive over its difficult financial situation and delays to the transition. The initial goal was to build a system that delivered more education to more people, particularly Māori, Pacifica and people with disabilities, and to do it better. However, a Tertiary Education Commission report has warned a drop in enrolments meant Te Pukinga's last annual deficit would surge to $110 million, $53.5 million more than it budgeted. Mr Hipkins said this system was no longer sustainable and that change was necessary. While Mr Kerr agreed change was needed, quote, the so-called reforms are basically a solution for the wrong problem, unquote. The core issue was the inadequacy of funding for the polytechnic sector, and between now and the final transition, there would need to be severe staff cuts across the entire network of providers and subsidiaries, he said. He believed hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent to reform a system that was not actually broken. Quote, not a single dollar has been put into improving the outcomes for learners, not a single dollar to strengthening the regional providers, unquote. Director General of Health Ashley Bloomfield has been in charge of the Ministry of Health during the COVID-19 pandemic, and now he's leaving his post 1 year early. At the same time, the country is embarking on a dramatic reshaping of its health and disability system. Dr. Bloomfield helped lead New Zealand through the COVID-19 pandemic over the past 2 years and has also worked through Samoa's measles outbreak and the White Island disaster. When asked at a press conference what's next for him, Dr. Bloomfield jokingly said, quote, lunch, but this will be followed by a, quote, jolly good break. The staff at Health New Zealand erupted into applause at the end of his final media conference. Those were your Radio 1 News headlines, and now for the weather.
The R1 News weather.
Today will be cloudy with light rain and southwesterlies. It will reach a high of 9 and a low of 7 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with southeasterlies and a few showers developing in the evening with snow possible about the hills. It will reach a high of 11 degrees and a low of 4.
That was your R1 News headlines and weather. Ngā mihi, Sophie, for doing that. Coming up on the show, we have our first feature. In fact, it's right now. Health and air pollution in New Zealand is an ongoing study which began in 2007, evaluating the effects of air pollution on human health across New Zealand, as well as the resulting social costs to New Zealanders. Earlier this month, a third instalment of the study was published. The results of this latest study came as a surprise to researchers who had underestimated the effects of air pollution in the country. The authors of the study, Kushal et al., concluded that human-made air pollution in New Zealand was responsible for approximately 3,300 premature deaths per year and social costs of $15.6 billion. Dr. Simon Kingham, who was the Chief Science Advisor to the Ministry of Transport, was a principal author on the original study, which began in 2007. I spoke with Simon about the concerning results of the latest study, as well as some of the policy solutions to the nitrogen dioxide pollution caused by transport. In Simon's eyes, the policies aiming to fix the problem of air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions will also help create a better society along the way. Here's our conversation.
So, kia ora, Simon. Thanks so much for joining me, mate. Health and air pollution in New Zealand is an ongoing study. The latest instalment, 3.0, of the study came out earlier this month. Even though you are no longer a principal author, could you still tell us a little bit about the latest one and what have we learnt from this one? Were the results surprising in any way, or were they tracking along quite consistently with the previous two instalments of the study?
So the new study is surprising because the numbers of people being affected by air pollution in this country, particularly traffic pollution, have increased dramatically. So that is surprising. The reason is in essence, is because the science has moved on, so we know more about it. So it isn't that suddenly more people are getting sick and dying from air pollution. It's just that we are now able to identify those people a bit more and understand the science behind it. And it's mainly because this time nitrogen dioxide has been included. So we've added an extra pollutant in. It's consistent with findings that are coming out overseas, and the science has been peer-reviewed, so we have good confidence in the science, but the numbers are dramatically higher of people dying and getting sick and missing work and all sorts of other things from air pollution.
So it was nitrogen dioxide pollution that was added into this study that wasn't accounted for in the previous two studies, is that?
That's right, yeah.
And nitrogen dioxide pollution is caused from internal combustion engines, cars which use petrol. Yeah,
that's right. Petrol and diesel. So it's mainly vehicles. So in the previous studies in New Zealand, the main source was actually domestic wood burning. So particularly in South Island, the new one now says we've still got the wood burning, which is getting better because we're better at heating our homes. But we now know that there are more people being affected by traffic than we thought before.
The study clarified the huge amounts of harm that's been done to human health in various city centres around the country. It's also got it's helped estimate how much it's actually costing New Zealand. $15.6 billion is the estimated total of what it's costing Kiwis in terms of addressing the air pollution harm. Do you think that this comes as a bit of a surprise to most ordinary Kiwis? You know, it feels like New Zealand has this reputation of being a clean air country, and especially when you look at cities like Beijing or LA with, you know, smog-filled city centres.
I think it will be a surprise because we didn't know the number was so big. It probably shouldn't be a surprise when we think about we don't have a particularly clean vehicle fleet. We have incredibly high rates of car use compared to other many cities in the world. And unfortunately, in some of our cities, we have, you know, the environmental conditions are such that the pollution kind of hangs around. So we some of our cities are we don't have huge wind problems, so that the pollution stays. So it is a surprise, but it probably shouldn't be if we really logically thought about it.
And so what's to be done if petrol cars are the issue? Is it as simple as just getting people out of them and into electric ones? And if that's the case, can you address some of the skepticism that people have around electric cars, namely the environmental impacts of lithium batteries, maybe, or the, you know, requirements of the electric grid to sustain the demands of electric vehicles?
Yeah. So I guess in the first part of your question, the good news is that in many ways the policies that are coming out to deal with greenhouse gas emissions and climate change are the same policies that are going to sort out this issue of nitrogen dioxide and other pollutants. So if we pursue the policies to reduce our emissions for climate change, we're actually doing the same thing. We're improving air quality generally. One of the things about climate change policy is that we've identified in that we can't just shift all our vehicles to electric. We actually need to change the way we travel and try and travel less. So the good news again is if we follow those policies, we actually do, you know, that's a good outcome. So one suggestion for the climate change work is that we've actually got to reduce our vehicle kilometers traveled by 20%. So we've actually got to work at home more, which of course many people are doing. We need to walk and cycle more and use public transport. So that's the good news. Yes, there are still, that's why, of course, it's also good not to just shift entirely to electric vehicles, because the electric vehicles, as you alluded to, have other disbenefits in terms of lithium in batteries, et cetera, et cetera. So there's multiple benefits of not just shifting entirely to electric. My understanding is that we're in a good position in New Zealand in terms of moving to electric, because the vast majority of our electricity produced is green electricity. So it is solar, wind, and hydro, of course, is the main one. And we can produce more, and we can increase our efficiency of using power, etc. So that one we should be able to deal with. The lithium one, batteries are becoming more efficient. They are being produced with less of those sorts of compounds in. So I think over time what you'll see is as more vehicles shift to being electric, the efficiency of the batteries will improve. And there's also a lot of work looking at what to do with batteries when they've finished their life, about reusing them in different ways. So some of those things, yes, they're things we should be concerned about. But as we shift to that more, they'll become less of issues because the technology is getting better.
So, Simon, you're the Ministry of Transport Science Advisor, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
Can you give us a bit of an idea about some of the policy suggestions that you've made to the ministry, and have we begun to see any real tangible change in the areas of transport And on top of that, I understand that you're a bit of a proponent of cycling. What is the Ministry of Transport doing much to get people on two wheels?
Yeah, I mean, what you'll have seen the last few years is increased amounts of spending on cycle infrastructure. So there are, historically, it's been left to local councils to do that. And increasingly, the central government is saying we will fund significant proportions of that spending. And I think the thing about cycling is it's a good mode of transport because it is low emission. It's also good for physical activity. It's good for community. It's good for noise. It's good for congestion. It's good for a whole bunch of things. And we have relatively low rates of cycle use in this country, and there's lots of potential to increase that. And it doesn't mean that cycling is going to be suitable for every journey for every person. But if we can get those people doing short journeys they do every day where they're just going to university or to school or to work, if we can get some of those onto bicycles, we get really good outcomes. But we have to acknowledge that they're certainly not, you know, you're not going to get tradies taking going to their building sites across town on bikes at the moment. And we shouldn't pretend that they're the people we're trying to, but what we should be doing is getting lots of students going to university, lots of kids going to school, people traveling to work on short journeys, going by bike. And the thing about that, we know that the biggest barrier, and the research supports this, is that people say they need to feel safe. And they don't feel safe on the road. So we do need to invest in infrastructure that makes people feel safe, because we know if you do that, you get more people cycling. And it's pretty simple, and it's relatively cheap, certainly compared to the cost of building roads, which is far more expensive.
In terms of just seeing kind of a different future for transport use in New Zealand, what kind of time frame are we dealing with? Obviously, we haven't been given a lot of time with the serious effects of climate change starting to kind of become apparent all around the world. It feels like it's more pressing now than it has ever been to kind of totally shift the way we interact with the world, how we travel, and how we work. And you've said there is going to have to be substantial change. People are not going to be able to travel as much as they used to. Eventually, we're not going to see any internal combustion engines on the roads. How far away is that from now?
So 20 to 30 years, you'll start seeing that. So it takes time. And part of the challenge is we don't have a lot of time if we want to meet our climate change obligations. And we're seeing just this week, we're seeing, you know, heat waves in England. I grew up in England. We never had this sort of heat. It's, you know, we're seeing floods in New Zealand this week. So we're starting to see why we need to do something. We want to start now. And the reality is that the sort of things we're talking about actually make society a better place anyway. You know, if you can have streets where there's less traffic, there's people cycling, kids can play on the street safely, that's a really good outcome. We also know that when people walk and cycle places, use public transport, they interact with their neighbors. That's good for mental well-being. It's good for resilience. So what we're actually trying to do is say, look, there's some really good things, some really good co-benefits of actually trying to reduce our reliance on single occupancy vehicles that produce greenhouse gases and air pollution. So we're just trying to, I mean, in many ways, if we can do this right, the world's a better place. But it is challenging because some people say, I have no choice, I have to travel this way. And that's why you have to invest to make the alternatives look attractive.
That's about all we have time for, Simon. Thank you so much for joining me and helping kind of outline this idea of a better society that we can all create for ourselves if we meet these climate targets, if we change the way we move around. And in some ways, it's quite exciting to see how we can change cities for the better.
Absolutely. It's exciting. I think it is about making the world a better place and also a healthier place and a better place all around. So, yeah, absolutely.
Lovely. Thanks, Simon. Good luck with all your work, mate. See you next time.
Nice chatting. Cheers. Right. Bye.
If you're just joining us now, that was Dr. Simon Kingham, a air pollution expert and the chief science advisor for the Ministry of Transport. He was talking about a recent study that actually began all the way in 2007 called Health and Air Pollution in New Zealand. It's an ongoing study, and it's been evaluating the effects of air pollution on human health across New Zealand, as well as some of the resulting social costs to Kiwis. Moving on, the next part of the show, we have Dr. Ian Chapman talking about universities running papers about individual celebrities. This is in the wake of the Texas State University's decision to have a paper about the musician Harry Styles. That's a live interview, and that's coming up in a few minutes. But before then, here's a song. This is Miyake with Infatuated. You're listening to The One.
Looking at a stranger. You really at my tide? Want me to fall in line? Am I the bad guy? Have I hurt your pride? We could turn around, try to calm it down, but I know us too well.
R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
Someday in bravery, I'll embody all the grace and lightness. Everybody understands me, but I wish nobody understood. Who did embody all grace and lightness? The world is pretty big. It's cool we fit on it. It makes me wanna go, so I can go see more. Sarah is a light beam from the picture Jonah said. So happy, she embodies all the grace and lightness.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
That was Embody by Frankie Cosmos. You're listening to Radio 1 R1 News. Texas State University announced this week that with the upcoming spring semester will make available a digital history paper focusing on the career of pop icon Harry Styles. This phenomenon is novel but not unique. The University of Southern California has a paper about Beyonce, while even here at Otago there is a paper about the multimedia of David Bowie. It has become more and more evident that there is something worth studying about these individual artists, but what exactly makes these stars so special? Here to help explain this phenomenon is the course convener of the University of Otago's David Bowie paper, Department of Music Senior Lecturer Dr. Ian Chapman. Kia ora, Ian.
Kia ora, Scott.
Much like Bowie, Harry Styles has transitioned from music into acting recently, starring in Dunkirk and Olivia Wilde's upcoming movie Don't Worry Darling. What makes celebrities like these worth studying in the classroom?
Well, it's because they're multifaceted. There are university papers. You mentioned Beyonce. And when I started the David Bowie paper in 2015, it started off as a trial sort of summer school paper, but it proved very popular very quickly. So now it's offered every second year at Otago. And at first some people said, you know, how can you have a university paper about a pop star? But the thing is that the people who have these kind of standalone papers about them are not just pop stars. They cross over into lots of different mediums, and they have some sort of societal, cultural impact that goes far beyond just being a pop singer. I mean, the likes of there are papers on Prince, papers on Lady Gaga, Madonna, etc., and all of these figures have in common the fact that they are not simply pop stars. They go way beyond that, and they have some sort of big cultural impact that is absolutely worth studying. And they also sort of critique what it is to be a celebrity. I know one of the things that always fascinated me about David Bowie back in the early 1970s is how he used to lampoon the idea of a pop star. You know, everyone used to think that these pop stars are sort of divinely created beings with God-given talents and so forth, but actually pop stars are constructions and they're carefully put together, and David Bowie knew that, and that's one of the things that made him very different. He was kind of like lampooning the very medium that he was exploiting, if you like.
What has changed over time about the role of celebrities in society that enables their critical examination and study in this way?
I think, excuse me, just getting over something a bit nasty. I think what's changed is there's become a more awareness of the manipulation and the construction that goes into this kind of thing. And when I say manipulation and construction, I'm not saying that these people are not extremely talented. They absolutely are, but they are kind of knowing. They know what they're doing. They're putting it together. I think, frankly, David Bowie was the first one, and that's why he's always been very fascinating to me. He's kind of a blueprint that a lot of these people, like Madonna, Lady Gaga, etc., that have come since have said, yeah, David Bowie was the blueprint. And these people cross over way beyond music. They go into fashion, they go into film, they're kind of influencers before there was the word influencer, if you know what I mean. And, you know, what I think is great about them, all of these figures actually, and I'm not going to do a talent comparison between them all, they all appeal to different generations, and they are all, in my view, a force for good and for tolerance and for making people think outside the square. And so they're absolutely worth studying, if only, other people that are not pop stars but are celebrities, even presidents perhaps, you know, there are models and things in place that if we learn about how celebrities are constructed, we can have a much more discerning and critical eye on what they're doing and see through the BS to a certain extent as well. So I think, you know, celebrity studies is a very important thing to do.
Unlike with Bowie, who sadly passed away in 2016, many of these celebrity papers focus on artists who are still living and often well into the prime of their careers. Why is now the time to study these people and not, say, 30, 40 years on?
I think that it depends on what their legacy lasts. They may still be studied in 30 or 40 years, and they may not. But it depends, because each generation has a figure like this that crosses all of these boundaries and makes people sit up and think and take notice. And I think it's important that people are aware of the artists while they are still active and in their prime. I say this, you know, in the 1970s with David Bowie, it would never have ever happened that he would have been studied at a university. So sometimes time needs to pass before people realise the value of what they've had in front of them. But I think there's a more knowing awareness now of the nature of celebrity, and that's why now you get a more immediate thing. People will be studied in the moment rather than necessarily just retrospectively.
What do lecturers... I mean, you've spoken about this sort of a lot in kind of the elements of your answers, but what do lecturers hope students will accomplish by studying these papers?
I think it will... For me personally, I like to think that someone as knowing and as talented as David Bowie, who knew what he was doing, who exposed the industry for the facade that it sometimes is, it's that taking the blinkers off, if you like, and making students aware of the manipulative aspects of celebrity. And so, you know, sometimes we are quite willingly manipulated if it's packaged well and the music's good. You know, I'm a huge David Bowie fan, don't get me wrong. But I think it's just a bit more mind-expanding to be able to see through, as I said, some of the more cynical aspects of stardom and celebrity is a very healthy thing.
Will papers like these become even more widespread across universities worldwide as time goes on?
Yeah, I suspect so, because these kind of crossover figures that touch all different sorts of disciplines and so forth. I mean, Bowie's very big in gender studies, for instance, and you're going to get papers in gender studies that will tackle these kind of artists as well. I think they will continue to... the numbers will stack up as more of these figures come along, because they're not going to stop. And I think they're, you know, basically a force for good, if I can use that term. So, yes, the short answer is yes, I think these kind of papers will continue to grow as more of these artists come to light.
Thanks very much for speaking with us, Ian.
No problem at all. See you later.
That was Dr. Ian Chapman of the University of Otago's Department of Music speaking about the phenomenon of celebrity papers after the announcement of Texas State University's upcoming Harry Styles digital history paper. You're listening to Radio 1.
Thanks for that, Scott. That was a lovely interview. Lovely interviewer and lovely interviewee talking about some of the new papers being offered around the world studying celebrities. Coming up on the show, we'll be moving into our next segment, which is a little explainer on the severe weather that we've been seeing in many parts of the South Island and some of the evacuations that had to occur around North Dunedin. But before that, here is The Beths with Expert in a Dying Field.
Can burn the evidence, but I can't bend the pain, and I can't.
That was The Beths with Expert in a Dying Field. You are listening to the R1 News. Health and air pollution, sorry. Heavy rains in Dunedin forced evacuations on Tuesday night this week, with Civil Defence Emergency Management continuing to monitor the situation. Residents in 36 properties near the Leith River were evacuated as a precaution, and an evacuation centre was set up at the Dunedin North Intermediate Schools Hall. However, only a small amount of people needed accommodation or support. Police Senior Sergeant said there were no major issues with getting students evacuated.
Yeah, most of the people were pretty compliant. There was a couple of flats that didn't want to move and a couple that didn't answer the door, I think. So not sure if it was the police knocking on the door or what the situation was there, but most people were pretty understanding of the situation. It's in their best interests and we just want to keep everyone safe at the end of the day.
Residents of the evacuated flats have since been able to return to their homes. Dunedin was not the only place to be battered by the severe weather this week. Many parts of the South Island faced widespread road closure as a result of slips and flooding. And according to Met Service, Christchurch has now officially set a new July rainfall record. The station at Christchurch Airport has so far recorded 228 millimetres of rainfall, beating the previous wettest July, which saw 180 millimetres of rainfall in 1977. Coming up on the show, we are talking to zoologist Andrew Johnson. It's Shark Week this week, so for Creature of the Week, we're talking great whites. We'll bring him in a moment, but before that, here's Kurt Vile with his song Pretty Pimpin'.
Thank you.
This is the R1 News on Radio 1 91 FM. Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi.
You've got it tuned to the R1 News. That last song you heard there was Kurt Vile with Pretty Pimpin'. Now on the show, it's the very special part of the show. It's Creature of the Week, and we have our zoologist friend. We used to call him zoologist in training, but we can't call him that anymore because he's official now, aren't you, Andy?
Yeah. Thank you. Cheers. Yeah, I handed him a master's, and it's all official.
Big so. Congrats.
Yeah, man. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's so cool.
Appreciate it.
It's Shark Week.
It's Shark Week.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh, Shark Week. A huge phenomenon throughout the world, Shark Week. It's amazing. I love it.
What does that mean? Are we just celebrating sharks this week? Are we like...
Yeah, I think originally Shark Week was kind of like this whole, you know, see how scary these animals are in the ocean, these huge, ferocious beasts. And I think it's slightly transitioned to a bit more of like a conservation-y thing. Like, let's have a look at these amazing creatures and see what they can do. And they really are amazing.
Is there a specific species we're talking about today?
Yes. So today, for Creature of the Week, for Shark Week special, we're going to talk about the great white shark.
Nice.
Because it actually has quite a history with Dunedin as well.
Really?
Yeah. So if you're listening, I definitely suggest that you listen to this whole story, because it can seem a bit scary, but we're going to talk about some conservation stuff as well. So very important to listen to the whole thing. But in Dunedin, I don't know if you guys know this, between 1964 and 1971, there were 5 great white shark attacks in St. Clair Beach.
Wow.
Yeah. With 3 of them being fatal.
My gosh.
Yeah.
And
What
years, sorry?
1964 to 1971. So about 50 years ago. And 50 to 60 years ago.
Wow. And since, we haven't really heard a peep out of
No, we haven't, yeah.
So fatal attacks, that's really scary.
Yeah. So there was even a theory at the time that those 3 attacks were caused by the same shark in the area. Mm. And there's another idea that potentially it was a story that inspired the Steven Spielberg's Jaws as well. Or,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. There was
the
idea
that one that happened, the
3 attacks that happened in the 60s here sort of like helped inspire that story. Yeah.
Wow.
So we really have a strong connection to Great White.
So
here
it should have been
Dunedin.
Set here. It should have been set here in Dunedin.
Can you imagine that with like Kiwi accents and stuff? I'm going to need a bigger bug.
That immediately paints them in a pretty bad light.
But let's
change the angle.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like they are scary. We can't deny that. But they're also incredible, and they're also so important for the ecosystem. They're incredibly important animals. But I think they have this amazing facet of both being this like incredibly ferocious beasts, but yes, so important as well. So I'd love to talk about that. About this kind of amazing stuff that they have and what they do for the environment and these amazing little like powers and superpowers that they have and what they can do. Yeah.
No, it's fair to point out. We need to acknowledge how scary they are and how I think Steven Spielberg played a huge part in actually turning the world against sharks.
Yes. There was actually a movement after Jaws came out to try and help people to do more conservation towards shark because of the negative effects that media portrayed. Yep. It was really, really interesting. Yeah,
there are some like awful statistics when you look at like, people are so afraid of how many humans sharks are killing a year. Mm. But then when you flip the stat,
oh my gosh, yeah, I found some incredible stuff.
Are dying every year?
Yeah. So I had a look. So between 2014 and 2018, there were 82 unprovoked attacks by sharks and about 4 fatalities per year, right?
Yeah.
Extremely tragic, okay? Yeah. But if you flip that around, humans kill about 100 million sharks a year.
Yeah.
Which is roughly about 3 to 4 per second.
Oh, my
like,
God.
If you kind of break it down like that. That's insane, right?
It's an insane number, yeah.
It blows my mind. I mean, it's for things that the reason they do that is for, you know, there's the obvious cases like shark fin soup and stuff overseas, but you also just have cases of people wanting the shark for their meat or for their cartilage for different oils and stuff in the shark, but also for bycatch in the fishing industry. And the other one is that some fishing industries will purposely kill sharks in order to increase fish population so they can then capture more fish.
That just seems so
100 million
short-sighted to kill the apex predator just to increase populations of fish.
It's so backwards.
What does that mean ecologically?
For what that does is that all these fish populations suddenly go skyrocket and go out of control and just completely unbalance the ecosystems. So then you got fish that are huge in number. Which cause more fish to be eaten, which kind of goes down this trophic cascade, is what it's called. So, excuse me. Go this trophic cascade, which is where things at the top of the ecosystem affect everything below it. So you fix something at an apex predator right at the top, it's going to affect everything else in the ecosystem. So it's right back down to, you know, the very smallest minute creature in the ocean. It's huge effects, yeah.
Yeah, that's really saddening, man. What we're doing to these lovely creatures? Maybe let's paint them in a different light. What are some fun facts?
Oh my god! Okay. So great whites are amazing. So they're actually the largest, the world's biggest predatory fish, right? So the biggest one you're going to find out there. They're about like 4 to 6 meters long, but the biggest one I ever found was 7 meters long and 2.5 tons.
Yikes.
That's large car size.
That's huge.
That's like, megalodon spec.
It's crazy. It's honestly crazy. And they can go about like 56 kilometers per hour in the ocean, and then they can jump 10 feet out of the water when they do that as well. 10 feet out of the water. Can you imagine like a 7-foot, 2.5-ton car? Oh my gosh, it's incredible.
And that's what I kind of know Shark Week as, is those images that Discovery Channel and Animal Planet are getting of the sharks doing. Just
breaching.
Incredible leaps out of the ocean.
Yeah. They got like somewhere between, where was it? I think it was like 500 teeth as well. So that's like 300 serrated teeth in 5 rows is what it is. And they'll keep losing and shedding these teeth, and they'll grow about 200,000 in a lifetime. These teeth that slowly just shed, and they grow new ones, because they're such predators. Yeah, they're amazing. And but some really cool fact that I found was, you guys might have heard that sharks can sniff blood.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's quite a commonly known thing. So sharks can smell blood from about 5 kilometers away, and they can sense about 1 drop of blood in 100 liters of water, which is crazy, right? What a killing machine. But they can also, which is something I learned, they can also sense electric fields, right? And they can sense as low as 1/1,000,000th of a volt in water.
And so how does that help them? They can just sense the electric field and other
and their prey. Bodies, so all the creatures in the ocean will emit some sort of electric pulse, and these sharks can sense it as low as 1/1,000,000th.
Oh my god,
that's incredible, right?
There's no hiding.
Yeah, but I will bring it back.
that make it less scary.
It's
right
very
now.
Unlikely. Yeah, it's very very unlikely that you're going to get provoked by so for great white shark, there's only been 100. Total incidences of great white shark with humans.
Full stop.
What? 100 total in existence. Like about that. But also, I have a list here of things that are more likely to get you than a shark.
Yeah. Oh yeah, help is our.
You're more likely to be killed by these things than a shark. You're more likely to be killed by a champagne cork, by fireworks, by a ladder, by lawnmowers, by a vending machine falling on you, by falling out of your bed. By coconuts and by hot dogs.
I had read that coconuts were 10 times more lethal than the shark.
Oh, yeah, they're
we
scary.
Should really be doing a
Steven Spielberg
week.
needs a coconut film.
That would be incredible.
I also heard that cows were more lethal than sharks in the water.
Really?
Yeah. In terms of by the numbers, you're more likely. You know, you think of all the places you find water on a farm and cows. You know, they're unrelenting. They don't care about you.
Yeah, they'll lose some teeth in you. They'll detect your electrical
signal. So maybe we need to have Moose as a movie. Might be Moose. Might need to get off the ground.
A Black Sheep's sequel. That'd be amazing.
Wow. So they're amazing. I guess it still stands that they're killing machines.
Yes. But they're not killing us. I think is
they're
the
not killing
thing.
Us.
I think is to say they're incredible killing machines, but they're not really killing us.
I've got one of these facts here that you've brought us ahead of time. The toxic blood, what's all that about? That sounds really interesting.
So they have, their blood is so toxic, it has super high amounts of arsenic and mercury in their blood, which, if that was the same for another animal, would instantly kill it. But they've somehow adapted to be able to have this extremely toxic blood in them, which means that other predators aren't as likely to try and kill them because they'll get this toxin.
Does that also mean that, say, shark fin soup's probably really, really bad for you given that it contains high levels of arsenic and mercury?
I'm sure there's some process they have to go through, Because sharks, although great white sharks, like we say, awesome predatory machines, killer whales actually hunt great white sharks.
Wow.
So they're even potentially a step above.
Okay.
Like, they'll go and they'll attack these sharks.
Okay. They're like our protectors almost. I guess.
Well, guardians. Even something, yeah, even greater, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. When you said that thing about they've evolved to have toxic blood in order to avoid predation, and they've also have these amazing, like, teeth. These things have all evolved over millions of years. Sharks are one of the oldest creatures in the book.
Sharks are older than dinosaurs.
What?
So sharks, so in some form or another, sharks have been around for about 400 million years. So that's why they've been able to evolve in such an incredible way, you know, with their torpedo-shaped bodies and be able to swim so fast and just be able to get all their food from other animals and whatnot. It's incredible. 400 million years of evolution has brought us this incredible predatory
animal.
Enough
time to leave you at the top of your game.
But then, and then you got the humans coming out on top now as well. So it's all a big issue.
And what can we do if we're concerned about these amazing apex predators? How can we help them out? How can we establish more balance to the ecosystem? What can we do as people on land?
So for us, there isn't a huge amount of things we can do, but something that is very practical and something very important is that what we can do is there's a movement to try and protect 30% of the ocean by 2030. It's a movement that's going through a lot of governments and stuff, and it's been proposed throughout the world. And so the idea is that we can protect at least 30% of our oceans, and there'll be breeding grounds for different species like sharks. They'll be able to flourish and come back to natural levels so that we can have a nice, healthy ocean once again.
Wow. And shark nets, they're bad, right? We don't want them.
To protect us from sharks?
Yeah, aren't there even some out at St. Clair, like shark nets?
Yeah. I think it's the only place in New Zealand that has shark nets.
But they're actually pretty... They don't help. They like...
There's a question of their, like, efficacy. Whether or not they're actually useful. Yeah. So, and it's probably not the best thing to have big nets in the ocean as well. It's never gone so well so far.
It's just Jaws-era thinking.
Yeah. I agree. But, yeah, there's also... just to let you know, if you go to St. Clair, you'll be able to find... a bell outright at St. Clair, which has shark warning bell on it. So that bell is still there because of all these shark attacks. So if there's a shark in the water, ring the bell.
Right, and it's kind of, there's a memorial just under it, isn't
there? There is, yes, for the three there who tragically died because of the shark attacks.
Yes.
So you can go visit it. And but if you go visit it this week, make sure to bring a rain jacket and stay warm.
Oh, well, Andy, thank you, mate. Thank you for changing all of our perspectives.
I hope it's a direction towards respect rather than fear. I think
they're beautiful animals and they deserve protection and not persecution. How many sharks a second did you say? Three a second.
Three to four per second.
That's shocking.
Respect and protect. And I think.
Thank you, Andy, so much for enlightening us once again an episode of Creature of the Week. You have been listening to the Thursday news show here at R1 News. I've been Scott and my co-host...
No, you've been Scott and I've been Seb.
I've been Scott and you've been Seb.
Yeah, that's how it's gone this week.
And can we give a bit of a rundown, mate, about what we've done today?
Yes, I spoke to Dr. Ian Chapman, the University of Otago's senior lecturer in music, about the phenomenon of celebrity papers and discussing Harry Styles and David Bowie as subjects of these papers.
Yeah, it was a great conversation, and Ian Chapman was the perfect guy to talk
about. Yes, very interesting guy to talk about.
And it was a good plug for his paper, David Bowie.
Every two years. So not this year, but next year.
Nice. I had a great conversation, a pre-recorded conversation with Dr. Simon Kingham, who's the Chief Science Advisor to the Ministry of Transport. We talked about air pollution and recent studies evaluating national levels of air pollution and the effects that this is having on human health and what we can do about it. And then we gave a bit of a rundown on all the heavy rain that's been hitting Dunedin as well as other parts of the South Island lately. It's all record-breaking stuff. Do your best to stay dry, stay warm, and stay out of the way of those great whites.
Yes, but respect them too.
What a way to end. Thank you for listening to the Thursday news show. And with that, here is Kane Strang. His song, Warping in the Sun. Cheers for listening, everyone.
I'm walking in the sun.
Thanks for listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. There are heaps more at r1.co.nz.